Well, I want to thank Ross Hoagland. I heard that you got a great response last week when you were talking here. So appreciate that very much. And where I was last week was in San Antonio. And I was at a church that has 13,000 people that regularly attend, and we had 15,000 show up. So I didn't get to address all the services. Fuzz Rano addressed some. But what was really interesting is that they were interviewing Fuzz and me about how we came to faith in Christ. And the senior pastor interviewed me. He wanted to know all about Genesis 1. But then he gave an invitation. We had over 190 people stand up saying that they wanted to give their life to Christ. And I got to talk to a lot of them afterwards. And it's amazing how many people came up to me and said, you know, I've been an atheist all my life. At least people have called me an atheist. But really, the only thing stopping me from becoming a Christian was how to reconcile Genesis 1 with science. And said, that all got taken care of this morning, so that's why I stood up and gave my life to Christ. And that was a bit of a surprise for me, that realizing, at least in the state of Texas, for how many people, that is the one thing that's stopping them from giving their lives to Christ. Although I had another set of people who basically said, all my life I thought, the only way to look at the Bible as the Word of God is to believe that the earth and the universe are less than 10,000 years old. And just hearing you today and realizing that that's actually a very weak translation of the Bible, because I was asked the question, you know, why do you think these days are long periods of time? And making the point, well, if they're not, then the Bible contradicts itself. But if they are, everything is consistent and literal. And a lot of people said that was the thing that was stopping them from becoming a Christian. So, and it's kind of opened my eyes to the fact that I'll bet you there's a lot of people in America and around the world for whom that is the big issue. And it was last January that I was gone here and doing 9 TV shows on Genesis 1. And John Ankerberg, the host, said, look, I know I've already interviewed you on this years ago. We're going to do it again. And his point is, I get so much mail that this is the issue that keeps people from giving their lives to Christ. So, and it kind of confirms things for us because, you know, we at Reasons to Believe spend quite a bit of money doing a DVD series with young people and non-Christians on Genesis 1 and realizing I think that really was a worthwhile thing for us to do. And what also was a thrill for me is that, you know, this is the biggest church event we've done in a couple of years in the United States at least, and just all the chapter help we got. We had volunteers from the Austin, Texas chapter, the Houston chapter, the Dallas chapter, all show up because the chapter we had in San Antonio was only like 2 months old. It was just barely launched. And then we had people come down from the Detroit chapter to help. So just seeing that kind of and that also had a big impact in the church when they just saw all the volunteers we had helping out at the event there in the book tables. And we wound up with over, well, I think it was about 200 people that signed up to join the San Antonio chapter. So it may become one of the biggest Reasons to Believe chapters in the country. So we'll see. And I think what's fun, too, is that I saw the chapter leaders talking to one another. And Austin and Houston are relatively close together. Then you got San Antonio a few hours drive beyond that. But they're talking about having regular meetings where at least those three chapters can get together. So that was fun. And, you know, I had no idea that that many of you were actually listening to Dennis Prager. And it was a touch and go whether I could even do it because what happened is I got a call at 8:30 in the morning saying, can you come on the show today? So I had to completely change my schedule so I could actually get on the show. But I literally cleared everything out because I know we've been working literally for 3 years to make that happen. And I found out that Dennis's wife, Susan, was a big factor in making it happen. And mainly it was because the producer wasn't there. They didn't have a producer to put the show together, so Dennis and Susan had to put it together themselves, and so I was kind of the stopgap. So, but I'll tell you, I had a lot of fun conversations with Dennis during the ad breaks. So, and his wife is a fan of Reasons to Believe and says, yeah, she's been after me for some time to do this. And then she kept texting all the way through the show and made a comment, you know, this program is the highlight of my life. And he said, gee, I took her to the Maldives, and she's saying that this is... So he's got a real sense of humor, which was kind of fun. But I can tell he's really attracted to the message we have at Reasons to Believe. And what he kept saying is, I want to talk about Genesis 1 because it's not just an issue for Christians, it's an issue for Jews. So many Jews do not take their Jewish faith seriously because of the problems they have at Genesis 1. And he had never heard our perspective before. And when he kept saying during the ad breaks, this is so reasonable, this is so rational. I mean, you know, how come I've never heard about this before? It just makes so much sense. So,
you're the best kept secret in the Jewish
right. Well, he was also impressed that a lot of Jews actually support Reasons to Believe, mainly because, you know, we bolster their faith in the Old Testament. So, but the other fun thing was literally the next day, I wound up having a Skype meeting with some Orthodox Jews. And, you know, these were men who were very serious. They weren't rabbis, but very serious about their Jewish faith. And they asked for the Skype call because they said, you know, as serious Jews, we really have problems with a flood account in Genesis. And everybody we've been talking to said, well, you need to talk to Hugh Ross about the flood. And I said, well, we are coming out with a book on it. It'll be out in March. There's four chapters on the flood in my new book, Navigating Genesis. And I've been told it'll be released probably within a week. We're going to be releasing that. You'll be getting information about that if you're on our Reasons to Believe mailing list. but the way these Jews put it, they said, you know, we read the text of the flood account in Genesis, and it sure sounds like a global flood. What do you think? And I said, well, I think it's a worldwide flood, but not global. I said, there's a difference? I said, yeah, there is a big difference. As you go through the Old Testament, what you notice is it describes numerous worldwide events, but in every case, it's the world of humanity. It doesn't mean the whole globe. And I says, I know you're not students of the New Testament, but there's a book in the New Testament, 2 Peter, Peter's second letter, where he talks about the flood. And they said, you mean the New Testament talks about the flood? I said, well, not just there. It's also addressed in the book of Hebrews. So he said, well, tell us what 2 Peter says. It says, the world of the ungodly was flooded. And I came back to them and said, you know, how far do you think the ungodly made it after God created Adam and Eve? Do you think they made it to Central Highlands of Greenland? They said, well, probably not. I said, well, how about the South Pole? Probably not. So I said, well, then why would God need to flood Antarctica and Greenland? And I said, well, let me press a little bit further. How far do you guys actually think people had settled by the time of the flood? And they said, well, Genesis 10 is the spreading of the nations. And so they actually figured out for themselves, without me having to tell them, that in the days before the flood, humanity probably only inhabited Mesopotamia and maybe regions around there. And then I said, well, you know, it's probably more than that. Have you ever heard of the Persian Gulf Oasis? And I said, no. And I said, well, and see, their big issue was Genesis 5 and 11 gives you a hard date for when the flood of Noah took place, namely about 5,500 years ago. And I said, well, I can understand your dilemma. If it's only 5,500 years ago, then how do you reconcile everything it says in Genesis 6, 7, and 8? And they said, well, what we Jews do is we say that that's just some kind of poetic myth. And there really was a man, Noah, but we're not to read a whole lot of specific details of what it says in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. And I says, well, let me guess. That's because you can't reconcile it with a date of 5,500 years ago. But what if that date is wrong? And they said, well, if that date is wrong, that means the genealogies are messed up in Genesis 5 and 11. And that's kind of where we got into it. I says, well, let's go back to those genealogies. What does it say in Genesis chapter 11? It says you've got 10 names mentioned. There's a guy there called Peleg. But if you go back one page, it says the world was divided in the days of Peleg. What do you think that means? They said, we haven't got a clue. And so what if it's referring to the actual breaking of land bridges on the earth? And they said, well, that would make the flood really early. And it says, well, yeah, but then now it makes it consistent in the sense that you can really read Genesis 6, 7, and 8 as talking about literal history and literal geography. And so it also solves the problem of Genesis 2. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's got four rivers coming together. And it says, yeah, that's a big problem for us Jews. How do you get those four rivers coming together in the Garden of Eden? And that's why we've always thought that the Garden of Eden's got to be up in the Armenian Highlands. And it says, well, if you got it up in the Armenian Highlands, because they kind of were reading it as the headwaters of the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Gihon, and the Pishon. So if that's the case, then you've probably got Adam and Eve living at 15, 16,000 feet above elevation. And as I read the text, they weren't wearing clothes. You know, how do you make it without clothes when probably the highest temperature you're going to be experiencing is about 20 degrees? And they said, well, yeah, that's an interesting point. So anyway, it wound up being an hour-long conversation about how to integrate Genesis 2 with the flood text and then with the genealogies. And what was interesting is these gentlemen were fluent in Hebrew. In fact, I was at a bit of a disadvantage because I was watching them through my computer, but they had screens up that I couldn't see. And one of the screens, they were scrolling the Hebrew text of these chapters, so they were telling me kind of what these Hebrew words were. And we wound up having about a 20-minute debate on the genealogies. And finally, they admitted these genealogies do not have to be read as a father giving birth to a son, and that son giving birth to another son, all named there. It could really be talking about a father giving birth to a son that winds up with a line of several descendants that ends with a particular name. And says, yeah, that can actually, the Hebrew can actually be read that way. And I says, we prefer to read it the traditional way, but we do admit that it can be read that there's actual gaps in the genealogies. And they said, we know you Christians do that, but that's because you believe the New Testament. In the New Testament, they have a parallel genealogy where it mentions a name that doesn't show up in Genesis 5. And it says, well, yes, we Christians have that, but you Jews also have Chronicles. Look at the genealogies in Chronicles. And it said, notice that those genealogies are not consistent with other genealogies in the Tanakh. And by the way, when you're talking to Jews, it's always a good idea to refer to the Old Testament as the Tanakh. They don't like calling it the Old Testament because in their view, there's only one Testament. So, but their word for the Old Testament is the Tanakh. So that's always kind of a good idea. So I just kept talking about that Tanakh. And they said, well, we haven't really looked at those other genealogies. And I said, well, there's lots of genealogies in the Tanakh. And I said, well, how do you read them? And I said, well, I don't read them as giving me a historical chronology. Says, I do believe those names that are mentioned are real people, but it's not an exhaustive genealogy. It's giving you the highlights. And says, have you ever looked at the names there and wonder why those names are chosen? And something they hadn't really considered, how in some genealogies it mentions women, other genealogies it mentions Gentiles. And says, that's where we Christians get the idea that the plan of salvation is not just for Jewish men, it's for Jewish women. And it's not just for people who are blood offspring of Abraham, it's also for the Gentiles. And so in that sense, we kind of look at the genealogies as being theological sermons. And so that's a rather interesting way to look at it. And I said, well, have you ever had children getting really frustrated about all these begats that they see in the Old Testament? I mean, it does seem rather dull that you've got all these genealogies in the Bible where all it is begat, 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 and a bunch of names. Says the one way we make it interesting for children is to say, why does this genealogy pick those names? Now suddenly it becomes interesting. And they begin to realize why so much of the text is devoted to these genealogies. Well, bottom line is they finally realize you really can read the genealogies as giving you an approximate date for Adam and Eve, but not an exact date, and likewise for Noah. And if you actually put Noah earlier, one thing you hadn't considered either, it says, look how long it takes the flood waters to leave. 7.5 months for the flood waters to leave. It wouldn't take that long if there wasn't snow and ice being melted. And I said, what's the point there? And I said, well, notice that the mountains of Havilah, from where the Pishon flows out of, aren't bone dry today. There's no snow there, there's no ice there, and this river that's identified in the Bible flowing out of the mountains of Havilah has been dry for over 10,000 years. And no water flows out. And it's the same thing with the Gihon. It flows out of the mountains of Cush. But those mountains today have no snow and no ice. So there's nothing in the way of meltwater to get those, because both those rivers flow through central and southern Arabia. And so they're not going to be able to flow based on rainfall. But they were mighty flowing rivers when the mountains of Havilah and the mountains of Cush were covered with snow and ice. And says, for that matter, the same thing is going to happen to the Tigris and Euphrates. Once all the snow and ice melts off the mountains of Armenia, those rivers will dry up. They'll become just like the Gihon and the Pishon. But if you're going to make sense of Genesis 2, those were four rivers that flowed out of those regions and joined together in the Garden of Eden. And it says, well, doesn't it call it headwaters? And it says, well, you're Jews, you know the Hebrew, check it out. Does it have to be interpreted like we interpret headwaters in English? I said, yeah, you're right. It really can have a broader definition. I said, well, it's got to, because notice that Genesis 2 tells you where each of the four rivers come from. So when it says they come together in the Garden of Eden, it can't be headwaters like we define it in English, because it's already told you where the headwaters are. One is in Cush, one is in the mountains of Havilah, and the other flows out of the territory of Asher. So the fact that it geographically identifies those locations and says, well, they said those four rivers don't come together anywhere. They said, well, if you go into the last ice age, almost all of the Persian Gulf is dry land. And then they come together. You know, we talked about that in the class here. Oh, if you go to the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf, that's where the four rivers come together. And at the time that Persian Gulf was largely dry land, all four of those rivers were mighty flowing rivers because they were fed by snowmelt. And that snowmelt would also explain why the flood lasts that long. You know, the rain stops, the underground aquifers are no longer pumping up water, but it takes 7.5 months for the water to flow out of that region into the Indian Ocean. Why? Because the water that's flowing into the Indian Ocean is being continually replaced by the ice and snow that's melting and feeding the flow of water down into the Mesopotamian plain and into the Persian Gulf. Just like what happened when the Mississippi Valley was flooded 50 feet deep, 15, 20 years ago. How long did it take that water to go into the Gulf of Mexico? It took 4 months. 50 feet of water took 4 months for it to leave. Why? Because the water that would flow down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico was continually being replaced by snowmelt. So it took a long time because it took a while for all that snow to melt and get carried out into that place. And said, you know, given that explanation, you now need a date for the flood that's probably in the neighborhood of 30 to 50,000 years ago. This 30 to 50,000 years ago, Genesis 2 can be consistently read with Genesis 6, 7, and 8. It can be consistently read with the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11. You also got enough time for the human population to multiply, because if you're looking at 5,500 years ago, how do you get all these people showing up so fast? But if you've got a few tens of thousands of years, you've got enough time. And they said, okay, we got one last question. There's only two of each kind of animal on board the ark. And you got, and they said, well, how about this? You've got a pair of predator animals and a pair of prey animals. They come off the boat, and then the predators eat the prey. What happens to that prey species? You mean, it's gone. And so you got that problem for hundreds of different species of life. And said, well, notice the text says for some of them, take 14, not just 2. So what's the difference? The ones where it says 14 are your agricultural animals, because you know God wanted civilization to be rapidly relaunched. And it says, you know, given that the flood was the area that humanity inhabited, yeah, there may be only, two lions on board the ark, but there'd be lions 1,000 miles away. And if you wait long enough, those lions will repopulate the region of Mesopotamia and the Persian Gulf. But God wanted them to have some contact right away. So, and you know, lions have a pretty good territorial base. So I said, oh, we thought it was all the animals in the face of the earth. No, it's just, you know, two of each kind that are there. And also recognizing, and it was funny watching them check the Hebrew. I says, notice it says one pair of every basar. What do you think that basar means? So they were kind of checking it out. Oh, yeah, soulish animal that is associated with human beings. So I said, I don't think there were polar bears on board the ark. If humans had no contact with polar bears, no need for Noah to rescue a pair of polar bears. I am curious how this new movie that's coming out is going to portray that. Whether they're going to have penguins jumping up on board the ark or... But really, it's just those bird mammal species that inhabited the region of Mesopotamia, the Persian Gulf, and the southern Arabia. Now, they were impressed that our model, it reasons to believe, is bigger than Mesopotamia, because they heard that everybody believes in the local flood, only believes the flood inundated the Mesopotamian plain. I said, well, if you got most of the Persian Gulf dry, then you inundate that too, and also good chunks of southern Arabia. And then talked about the villages they had discovered. They hadn't heard about that. Amazing discovery, how this German archaeologist found 60 villages at the very edge of the present-day Persian Gulf. They measure to be the most ancient villages ever discovered. And he also noticed villages a little higher up, and what he was able to conclude, these are villages that were built as the sea level in the Persian Gulf was rising. And so the people are simply moving their villages up to higher and higher ground. And here's this unbelieving German archaeologist concluding, this must be evidence for the flood. Because otherwise, why would you have these villages ringing all around the Persian Gulf? The flood must have, the civilization must have been centered in what is now the Persian Gulf. And the other humorous thing is I said, well, if you really are talking the Persian Gulf oasis, it explains the waters that come up from below. Because underneath the Persian Gulf is a huge underground aquifer. Also explains why Adam and Eve were quite comfortable not wearing clothes. If you're in that region of the world, it's really nice and warm and humid. You're not going to need clothes. If you're up in those mountains of Armenia, you've got a problem. So, anyway, it was a fun time talking to these Jews, and we're going to have another meeting as well. But it was interesting how many of their questions and issues were the same I was getting from Dennis Prager. So, also I said, well, you know, why did you contact us? I mean, clearly you're in contact with rabbis. And their point was, well, rabbis don't know this stuff. So that's why we contact Christians. In fact, what I've been finding out is they've been doing these Skype meetings with Christian leaders literally around the world. And also dialoguing with rabbis. But what they said is we get many more answers to our questions when we talk to Christians than we do when we talk to rabbis. And that actually got into an interesting discussion because, you know, once we talked about the flood, they said, well, you know, we know that you Christians believe that the Messiah is God. We Jews don't, because nowhere in the Old Testament does it ever say that Jesus or the Messiah is God. And I said, well, I think you're right. Nowhere in the Tanakh does it tell us that the Messiah is Jesus of Nazareth. You won't find that. But I said, what you will notice is that the Messiah is given 88 different names. And I said, well, that must include the New Testament. I said, no, just the Old Testament. The Tanakh by itself gives you 88 different names for the Messiah. And I said, would you guys be curious as to what those names are? And I said, well, one of the names is Yahweh. Now, that really got him. Okay, here's a Tanakh saying that the Messiah is Yahweh. It's Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6. The name by which he will be called, Yahweh. So I use that passage, by the way, in Jehovah's Witnesses. Because if they don't believe that Jesus is God either. And you know, their whole idea, only Yahweh is God. Well, it's one thing that Jews and Jehovah's Witnesses agree on. But it says, look at what you see there in Jeremiah 23. And he also made the point that Jesus never said that he was God. And I says, well, yes, he did. So, anyway, an interesting discussion, which segued into the Trinity. And they said, you know, I know, he said, don't you Christians get the doctrine of the Trinity out of Genesis 1? I said, well, that's one place, because it does use the plural pronoun for God when it talks about creating Adam and Eve. And it uses a singular pronoun. It says, look at this. Two sentences in Genesis 1, and one God refers to himself with a singular pronoun, the other one refers to himself with a plural pronoun. I said, well, we Jews have always thought that God was using the royal we to include the angels. And I said, well, it seems to me that if you got it just one sentence after the other, that the text is making a purposeful point. And says, you know, what do you see in Genesis 1:1? In the beginning, God created. Okay. What's the word for God there? Elohim. You can look up the lexical definition of Elohim. It means the uniplural one. The one who's both singular and plural at the same time. So, anyway, I said, where do you think we Christians get our doctrine of the Trinity? And they said, well, obviously the writings of the Apostle Paul. I said, well, not really. I said, where we get our doctrine of the Trinity from is the book of Isaiah. And I said, well, we've read Isaiah 52 and 53. You Christians keep throwing that at us all the time about the suffering Messiah. He says, I'm not talking Isaiah 52 and 53. I'm talking Isaiah 40 through chapter 50. Have you ever looked at those texts? And he said, no. I said, well, I got the same answer when I talked to David Block. And they knew who David Block was. He's the chairman of the astronomy and mathematics department at Witwatersrand University. An Orthodox Jew became a Christian. And most Jews have heard of him because he's a leading figure in Jews for Jesus. But I said, you know, I once asked David, how did you, an Orthodox Jew, become a Christian? He said, by reading all the Old Testament passages my rabbis forbid me to read. And I said, the text that they told me never to read was Isaiah 40 through 49. I said, you know, I was a young scientist. I figure the rabbis don't want me to read this stuff. I better at least see what they don't want me to read. So he read those texts, and it says the Trinity just jumped off the page. And that was the big factor that persuaded him to give his life to Christ. Yes?
If I want to Google him, so it's David Block.
Yes. Yep, and there's actually people in this class who've personally met. I don't see him here today, but he's a physicist who usually sits right here. He's been to South Africa and I've met David. I've known David a long time. We've often shared the platform together. He gets to speak to much bigger audiences than I get to speak to, mainly because his personality is much more flamboyant than mine. You get him on the stage, he's jumping up and down. Yeah, he's a native South African, but an Orthodox Jew. I'll tell you more about this. He was the first Jew in his family to become a Christian. And when he gave his life to Christ, his Jewish family held a funeral for him and basically said, we're going to treat you as dead from here on in. So they cut off all contact, no mail, no phone, nothing. And he said, you know, I would send my parents gifts at the Christmas time and you know, at Passover, and they'd always be sent back. So, you know, they wouldn't receive anything. He says, all that changed after more than a decade when he and his wife had children. And he said, you know, the thing about Jewish grandparents, they got to see their grandkids. So they basically said, we're going to treat you as dead, but we're not going to treat the grandchildren as dead. So they came. And he told me about a story where there was about 60 to 65 of his Orthodox Jewish relatives in his home. And this after they'd seen the grandkids. But then he said, my uncle, who is kind of the staunch patriarch of the family, picked a fight with me. And I said, you know, we're not going to argue. What we're going to say, you know, I'm a scientist. We're going to do an experiment. And what we're all going to do is we're going to emigrate to Israel, or at least fill out the forms to emigrate to Israel. So he actually handed them out to all the relatives there and says, notice on this application for immigration to Israel, you have to write down your religious preference. So he says, and he gave out little cards where each of them got to pick 65 different religious perspectives, including atheist, Muslim, Hindu, you name it. It was all down there. He says, I'm going to put down evangelical Christianity on mine. and let's all submit these and see what happens. And so several months later, he brought the relatives back and said, okay, what happened? Everybody got accepted except David Block. His was rejected. So he said to his uncle, can you explain to me why all of you were accepted for immigration, but I was rejected? His uncle stood up and said, we Jews only fear the truth. He says, that night, a third of his relatives came to Christ. So just through that simple little experiment.
David Block, what's his official title?
He's the chairman of the astronomy and mathematics department at Witwatersrand University.
The chairman of the mathematics department.
Astronomy and mathematics department. He's most famous for writing a paper where he talked about the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. And he did research on these dwarf galaxies that exist in the neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy and our galaxy, and was actually able to show through his infrared observations that a galaxy we call NGC 205 punctured the Andromeda galaxy and came out the other side and distorted the spiral arms, basically warped the spiral arms. If you actually look at the Andromeda galaxy on the internet, you can see that the spiral arms have been warped. But he was actually able to identify the cause of the warping. And then with a group of other astronomers said, if we look at spiral galaxies, the Andromeda galaxy is typical. The Milky Way galaxy is the exception. No warped arms. And the arms are symmetrical. You can't see any bending in the symmetry of the arms of the Milky Way galaxy. And the bottom line is this. Of all the gas spiral galaxies we can see, none of them have the symmetry and the size and the lack of spurs in between the spiral arms that makes advanced life possible.
Is that what converted him to...
No, he wrote that as a Christian. He was already a Christian, but yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal piece of evidence that, you know, we live in a galaxy that allows the existence of advanced life and these other spiral galaxies don't.
When you Google him, will it talk about his conversion or anything like that, or is it more just the
actual... Well, if you Google his name, it'll definitely tell you that he's a Christian and that he's allied with Jews for Jesus. You'll probably also see that he's allied with Reasons to Believe. He heads up Reasons to Believe for us in South Africa.
Yeah, I apologize. Please, Department of what again? I'm going to write it down.
Astronomy and Mathematics.
Department of Astronomy and Mathematics.
At WIT, Witwatersrand. WITS. Yeah, WITS. It's actually WITS because it's Afrikaans. So, but WITS is enough. It's the largest university in South Africa, and it's in Johannesburg.
Okay, which university in South Africa? Department of Astronomy and Mathematics.
Yeah. Yeah, if you Google his name, it'll come up. And, you know, he gives these incredible presentations where he shows people the beauty of the universe and uses that as a way to show the plan of salvation. You know, his whole message is, the heavens shout the glory of God. And he regularly speaks to 10,000 to 15,000 people at a time with his slideshow. But the fun part is watching him in addition to the slides.
Well, when you talk to these Orthodox Jews, if you could somehow get an audio tape, and I'll just buy it from you.
Well, the one I had with these Jews a few days ago, they said, we do not want this recorded. Mainly because they wanted to have a free, open, and frank discussion. And I said, well, you're concerned that Jews might actually see what you guys are thinking about. So they kind of laughed. But and another thing that I think was really good, and I think this ties into what you were saying last week, Ross, when you spoke, is talking to these Jews, mentioning the fact that, because we talked about grace and how that's a huge difference. Because in Judaism, and I saw this with Dennis Prager, the way you get to heaven is through good works. And if you simply really focus on being a good person, being moral and rational and logical, that will get you into heaven. And the Christian message is, you get to heaven through the work of Christ, not through your own works. And but I remember talking to these Jews about, in the New Testament, it tells us that God was actually anticipating our rebellion and our sin before he created anything. Whereas in Judaism, God is reacting to the sin that's introduced. Whereas in Christianity, God had a plan all along. And they said, well, we've never heard that before. Where does it say that? I said, well, look at the writings of the Apostle Paul in Titus and 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 1:9. The grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time. And Titus 1:2, the hope that we share in Jesus Christ was given to us before the beginning of time. The fact that it mentions grace before God creates anything means that God was anticipating the entry of sin and evil. And before he created anything, actually built into his creation plans a strategy for eliminating sin and evil once and for all. So that was all built in before he created anything. And that kind of led to an interesting discussion. I think I've shared this in the class before. You know, Jews, God is one and only one. But here we got God bestowing grace before he creates anything. If God is all by himself, then how do you understand this grace? How do you understand love? I mean, there's nothing to love. There's nothing to bestow grace on. He's all by himself. And so it kind of used a segue. It says, look at Islam. The God of Islam is distant and rather cold-hearted. And, you know, whatever he does, whatever he does. And it's because in Islam, God is one and only one. There's no relationship. There's no love relationship that exists until God creates. And also in Islam, and likewise in Judaism, God must create. Creation is not an option. In order for God to experience love, he has to create. Whereas in Christianity, God doesn't need to create. He's already experiencing love. That relationship is going on between God the Holy Spirit, God the Son, and God the Father. They have no need for anything else. They're complete within themselves. There's nothing that we have done that adds to God's love. Nothing. Whereas in Judaism, in Islam, that we human beings are actually contributing to God. And so he said, yeah, you're right. In Judaism, we think through our good works, we can help God. In Christianity, our good works do nothing to add to God, do nothing to add to his love. Because God was complete within himself before he created anything. But his plan in creation was to provide a solution to our sin and evil. And says those passages in Timothy and Titus tell us God's going to do it. We're not going to do it. So that's kind of where our conversation ended. They said, you know, we got to think about this. And we need time to think about this. Let's get back together in the future. That's kind of where it all ended. And I got to share a little bit of that with Dennis as well. So, yes.
In the Jeremiah 23 passage.
Yes.
You mentioned Yahweh. Now, I looked it up. And the word for Lord is Adam or Adonai on there. So how do you bridge that over to the Yahweh?
I may have the wrong passage, but
Lord is Yahweh.
It is Yahweh.
The word in Hebrew is Adam or Adonai.
No, it's Yahweh of righteousness. Lord of righteousness.
The Lord
righteousness
of
righteousness is
Adonai.
Yeah, the Lord.
Is, so it's Yahweh.
Yeah, the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. That's how it comes across in the English translation.
Correct.
But the word Yahweh there is a title for the one that's going to be called the righteous one.
I looked it up in Vines, and it says the Lord is Adam, Adonai, I believe.
Well, okay.
No, Yahweh, it is Yahweh, Lord. That word is Yahweh.
Yeah, I've brought that up with Jehovah's Witnesses before, and they admit that the word is Yahweh. In fact, if you look in the Jehovah's Witness Bible, they actually alter that translation. A name by which he will be called the Lord our righteousness, and they add said the Lord will be our righteousness. So that's how they managed to take the deity off of the Messiah by actually adding a verb that's not there in the text. So they feel the compulsion to deal with it because it said, yeah, if we leave the verb out, we're stuck. Yes.
How did these Jewish people become familiar with your work? And how did they get to know?
Well, how they became familiar with our work is that, these guys are really intellectual Jews. They're fluent in Hebrew. They've been talking to their rabbis about these problems. And basically they're saying, we're really struggling in our Jewish faith because we just can't put these things together. They're engineers and scientists, so they really feel a need to find some way to integrate the science with the text. I kept referring to the Book of Nature and the Tanakh needing to be integrated. I said, yeah, that's our problem. And when they weren't getting very far, the rabbis, they started pursuing Christians. Because what they discovered is that your typical Christian scholar often knows the Tanakh better than the Jewish scholars do. So they wanted to talk to them. And they said, we've noticed that you Christians don't seem to be bothered by these texts like we are. And we wanted to find out why you're not bothered. And our presumption was it was the New Testament that relieved you of these difficulties. So they, even when we just got started in the conversation, they said, we know you Christians rely on the passage in Luke to deliver you from the problem of the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. But he says, we Jews do not respect Luke as the inspired word of God. So for us, it's a problem. For you Christians, it's not. And so, well, that's not the only place that causes a problem with your interpretation of the genealogies. If we just stick to the Tanakh itself, you've got the same problems. And so how they heard about us, they were talking to other Christian apologists, and they said, well, if you've got questions about the flood, you need to talk to Hugh Ross. So that's when they contacted us. Yes?
You said is it Elohim or Elohim is this the plural?
Yeah, it's the name you see for God right there. Like in Genesis 1, it consistently uses the word Elohim for God all the way through. Genesis 2, you get Yahweh as a name for God.
But do you say Elohim is
if you look at the lexical definition of Elohim, it's basically the uniplural one.
Uniplural, okay.
Yeah.
Because there's a blessing, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Eloheinu, is Eloheinu related to Elohim?
Yeah, it's the same root word.
It's the same root word.
Yeah.
So when it's saying Shema Yisrael and Eloheinu,
that's the great irony. That's the one passage Jews quote over and over again to prove that God is one and only one, and yet it uses that word.
I'll be a son of a...
Yeah, right. Go ahead.
I noticed when you were conversing with Dennis, and he would raise a new topic, like the Sabbath, I think was later in the discussion, but before that, every time you pick some biblical reference to make a point, you pick one of Paul's writings and give Paul the credit for what Dennis agreed with. Because I've heard Dennis in a different conversation with a Christian, every time Dennis refuted something in that discussion, he would always say, that's a Pauline distortion. But it was beautiful that you used Paul so many times in what Dennis could agree with.
Well, I knew that was a hang-up for Dennis. And yeah, I mean, I knew he was going to get to the Sabbath sooner or later, and that's kind of where everything ended. So he basically said, Sabbath is Saturday. Do you worship on Saturday? And that's where I said, well, if we look at what Paul writes, he says, those of you who worship on Sunday should not condemn those who hold Saturday as a Sabbath day. And those who hold Saturday shouldn't condemn those who are looking at the Sunday. And Paul basically says you can pick any day you want. And I said, the real principle of the Sabbath is we need to set aside a day out of the week where we focus on the most important issues of life. And that's where he jumped in and said, I've been preaching that for decades. That's exactly how we need to interpret the Sabbath. And we all get hung up on, what day it is. But the real thing is we need to take a day aside. What he told me over the break, he says, on Saturday, I don't watch TV. I don't read the newspapers. I don't read commentaries. I need to do this for my job. But on that day, I don't do any of that. Instead, I just truly try to focus on my relationship with God. And I says, well, that's something that I definitely agree with. And just told him stories about how I've met scientists who are so distracted by their scientific research, they never begin to think about what's going to happen to me when I get old and have to face death. And so those are the questions we should be dealing with literally on a weekly basis. That's the real principle of the Sabbath. He was so excited. He said, you know, I totally endorse that, and that's something that we can really unite on. And then, you know, off the air, just made the comment, you know, this whole debate about Saturday or Sunday, we're presuming we got the calendars all nailed down. You know, what if we're off by a day on the Gregorian calendar? I mean, or one of the other calendars. And, you know, maybe you Jews are actually working on Thursday and not Saturday. I mean, and likewise we Christians, which is, I think, what the value of what Paul says is, pick any day you want, but pick a day. Make sure that you actually take time out of your work schedule, because it's so easy for us to get just bogged down in our work or our recreation. We never take time to think about the most important issues of life. And hey, it really helped that the show I was on was actually called The Important Issues of Life. Every Tuesday, he does a show on the important issues of life. So,
yeah, he said, that's another joke for me.
Yeah, he got it. That was good. But, you know, I've had a lot of help, especially through his wife, Susan, in getting things prepped. And it helped, too, that I'd been on a show 20, 25 years ago. He used to have a show called Religion on the Line, where it'd be a rabbi, a Roman Catholic priest, and a Protestant minister. And then he would be the Jew moderating the dialogue. And I was on his show five times back in the late 70s and 80s. And what I remember is that almost every time, every time I was on, Dennis would come to my side against the other two. So, because it seems like every time I was on, there was a liberal rabbi. And you know Dennis, he despises liberal rabbis. And so he would jump to my side against the liberal rabbi and the liberal Roman Catholic. Although there was one time where there was a conservative Roman Catholic priest, and we got in a discussion about grace. And the Roman Catholic priest basically came and said, you know, I have a problem with standard Roman Catholic theology, where they say it's grace plus works. It's grace and nothing else. You know, he actually said that on the Religion on the Line. So he came, that's when he came to my side. And then we got into a debate with the two Jews about whether it really is just grace and not works. Yes?
You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
Well, a few years back, Kathy and I had dinner with Susan and Dennis Prager and with two other Christian couples. I didn't get to say much that evening, but it became clear that Susan has been a reasonably fan since 2004. She discovered us in 2004. Has read most of our books, so she's the one that's really been trying to get Dennis to get on his show. So I suspect she is a Christian, but she obviously has great admiration for Dennis. And
she would marry somebody who wouldn't turn Jewish.
Well, she goes to synagogue with him. She takes his classes because, you know, he's a professor at the Jewish university, so he's taking his classes. And I think she identifies herself as a Jew, but she sure seems to have a lot of Christian beliefs under her belt as well. So.
And I think his other wife, I think I recall him saying she was Presbyterian, but she obviously, they were going to bring their children up Jewish. So she probably agreed to that. I don't know. Probably converted.
Well, in the case of Susan and Dennis, children isn't an issue.
Right.
So.
Exactly.
And I don't know many more about Susan than that, so I can't tell you exactly where she stands, but she seems to be a real super fan of Reasons to Believe, so good chance that she really is a believer. So, and he obviously admires her a lot and respects her a lot, so we'll see. I mean, I've got hope for Dennis. I've always had hope for Dennis. Every time I've been on a show, and going back to the 80s, he was always very receptive. And we even got to talk about Jesus once. Literally for a whole hour, we talked about Jesus on the show. And his whole thing is, well, Jesus, when he came here, only fulfilled a third of the prophecies. And we Jews aren't going to bite until we see a Messiah that fills all the prophecies. And you know, my response at that time was, well, you know, one third still adds up to over 100 prophecies that he fulfilled in one coming. How can you pull that off if you're just simply trying to fake it? And it says, look at all the prophecies he fulfilled that he had no control over. And by the way, there were two other messiahs that claimed to be a fulfillment of the Old Testament Messiah. And the one that came the closest to Jesus of Nazareth, we lived at the same time. His name was Bar-Jesus. And he was able to fulfill 8 of the prophecies. Jesus fulfilled 109. And the 8 that Bar-Jesus fulfilled were all prophecies that were under his control. So that's why Jews reject Bar-Jesus. But they also reject Jesus because he only fulfilled a third. The irony of that is Orthodox Jews, now the conservative and the Reformed Jews don't do this, but Orthodox Jews, when they celebrate Passover, they have an empty chair for Elijah because they believe Elijah is going to come again. Well, if Elijah comes twice, why can't the Messiah come twice? And if Elijah can fulfill some of the prophecies about him in one coming and the rest in the second coming, why can't the Messiah do that? And the great irony there is they have that empty chair for Elijah. So, and also, if you look at, we've had people here do an Orthodox Jewish Passover. It's, if it's done the right way, the master of the Passover actually hides a piece of the bread that they celebrate at Passover and hides it. And the children are sent out to find that missing piece of bread. And if they find that missing piece of bread, they can ask the master of the Passover for any gift they want. So who do you think that little piece of matzah is in terms of the way they celebrate the Messiah? So in that sense, the elements of the gospel right there. And that was interesting talking to David Block. He says, after I became a Christian, the Passover made sense. Everything we did in the Passover was pointing to Christ. It's just that we never saw it. Yeah.
The middle, it's supposed to be, I think, the middle matzah. It's called the afikoman.
Right.
You break it in half. So is that supposed to symbolize the breaking of Jesus' body?
The broken body of Jesus, exactly.
And then when you wrap it in a cloth and hide it, so is that cloth supposed to be part of his shroud or whatever? That he was buried.
Well, not only that, in some Orthodox Jewish Passovers, you have burnt scars along the matzah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like it's going to be bruised. It's actually all reference to Isaiah 53. You know, how he's going to be, you know, he'll carry the stripes that he was bruised with, and his body will be broken.
You know, because when I was a kid, I used to celebrate Passover. The youngest kid asked, more questions, why is this night different than the other?
Right, one? Right.
It's been a long time since I've asked this question, though. But not the youngest. But the thing is, I just lost my. So we, of course, we never mentioned Jesus, and what I was going through, I didn't quite really understand. But if I was a 10-year-old kid and my Zeta, my grandfather, would break the matzah, can you believe what would happen if I said, that's Jesus' body you're just broke? And what did you say? I'm just saying that.
So you want to go back in time and make that happen, I can tell.
Well, it would be interesting, but I mean,
that's better than that, when you ask the Jew, why is there 3 masses and why do you break the middle one? They don't know. They debate that. They debate there's 4 explanations and no Jews agree on it.
Really?
Well, you know, it was really interesting talking to these Jews, though, is they were familiar with Psalm 2. And they realized that Psalm 2 was speaking about the Messiah.
Is that King David's Psalm 2?
That's King David, yeah.
And what is the Psalm 2? I'm sorry.
Psalm 2 is where King David talks about God's Son and how we need to come to God's Son to have our minds instructed. Then we're to submit our will to God's Son, and then we're to kiss the Son.
Oh, it's not 22, it's 2.
Yeah, Psalm 2, yeah. They were not at all familiar with Psalm 22.
Well,
So I encourage them to read Psalm 22, but they were familiar with Psalm 2. Well, Psalm 22 is also written by King David. And yeah, I mean, every Jew I meet, I try to get them to read Psalm 22.
Could you say it real quick?
Yeah, real quick. It begins with, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it ends with the phrase, it is finished. What were the first words of Jesus on the cross? My God, why have you forsaken me? What were his last words? It is finished. What you see in Psalm 22, written 1,000 years before the crucifixion of the Messiah, is a detailed prophecy of how the Messiah would die, how he would be hung up on a tree, how there would be nails through his feet and his hands, how a spear would pierce his side. And I think what really impresses me, it even documents the words of the Jewish leaders in their mockery of this Messiah on the cross. The actual words are predicted right there in Psalm 22. It also predicts that he would be surrounded by a band of Gentiles who would basically toss lots for his clothing.
This is all in 22?
It's all in Psalm 22.
I can remember.
Yes.
22 and then there's the other one with 2.
When I've been able to get Jews to read that, it's a real shocker for them. You know, here's King David, 1,000 years ahead of time, predicting in great detail how the Messiah would die. If you actually put that in the New Testament context, there's a story there, the centurion who was in charge of the crucifixion, and he's watching and listening to everything that's going on. What does that Roman centurion say when Jesus dies on the cross? Surely this was the Son of God. Now, a lot of these Roman soldiers that were there at the time were called good Gentiles in the sense that they were students of the Tanakh. And so there's been many scholars who have speculated that this Roman centurion knew Psalm 22. And what he was seeing and hearing was the fulfillment of Psalm 22 right before his eyes. He wasn't Jewish, but if he was one of these what they're called good Gentiles, in other words, righteous Gentiles who go to synagogue and actually read the Tanakh and study the Tanakh, looking for God, then if he was in that category, good chance he would have been familiar with Psalm 22 ahead of time. And you can imagine the impact that would have on the centurion, hearing Jesus' words on the cross. In fact, some have speculated that what you actually Jesus was doing when he was dying on the cross was quoting verbatim Psalm 22.
Now, when he says, "Oh God, oh God," is that kind of implying, okay, God, the Father, the Holy Spirit, but he leaves out himself? Because if it's supposed to be a Trinity, he's saying, "Oh God," twice, or is that overanalyzed?
Well, in a sense it is, because look how frequently you see in the New Testament claims that Jesus rose himself bodily from the dead. You can get another text that says the Holy Spirit raised him bodily from the dead and the Father raised him bodily from the dead, but there's only one resurrection. So it's kind of the doctrine of the Trinity. All three are involved and all three can claim credit for the resurrection, but there is just one God. You're next, then I'll come back here. Yeah.
The difference between Judaism and Christianity is basically Christianity has a two-coming Messiah and Judaism has a one-coming Messiah.
Right.
You just talked about the suffering Messiah, which in the Bible is often, or we call then Joseph. Then there's the victorious Messiah, Ben David. Jews are looking for the one-coming Ben David.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do they have any concept of a Ben Joseph, Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, at all?
Well, these Jews I talked to a few days ago were very familiar with Isaiah 52 and 53 and the Christian doctrine that the Messiah comes first to suffer and later comes as the victorious one. And they said, we know you Christians like that story. We don't. We want the Messiah to come as a victor. And we're looking for a Messiah that does everything in one coming. And I said, well, then how do you break into the suffering part? That seems inconsistent. It says there's a really good reason why we Christians believe in two comings. Because you really can't combine the suffering and the dying for our sins with him coming as a victor at the same time. It really doesn't work.
And is there an answer to how they do it, the suffering part?
they didn't really have a good answer. In fact, you know, it was really a shocker for me. They really didn't understand those last chapters of the book of Deuteronomy. Because, you know, we were getting into a debate. Well, you know, the Messiah cannot be greater than Moses. Moses is the greatest of the prophets. But it says, look what Moses said about the Messiah. That there'd be one that would come after him that was greater than him, and one for whom you must do everything he says. Now it says, you and I all know that Moses was not a perfect man. You know, there were things in his life. In fact, you know, God wouldn't let him go into the promised land because of what he did. But what does he say to the Messiah? You must do everything that he commands you to do. He's in a different category. And he said, well, we don't accept that. And I said, well, please look at those last chapters of Deuteronomy. And I said, mainly because it's also going to help us with our debate on works. Because what Moses says at the very end of his life, you Jews think the law is going to save you. It won't. You can't keep the law. What's going to save you is the one that will come after me.
What is that? What chapter?
Yeah, start in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy and read all the way to the end.
28 of Deuteronomy.
Right. You might even want to start in 27.
I'll start in 27.
Okay, start in 27.
27 of Deuteronomy.
Hey, what was really wonderful with these Jews, I said, you know, here's Moses giving a sermon at the very end of his life. Don't you think that's probably the most important words of Moses to read for any Jew? I mean, here's this man who's about to die, and he's giving one last sermon to his people. You know, if you were in that position, wouldn't you make your most important message into those last that last sermon? I said, yeah, you're probably right. And, you know, so they said they promised me that he would actually read that portion of Scripture.
Would that be sort of the prelude to the Sermon on the Mount from you think? Sort of a lead into it?
Well, the wonderful thing about those chapters is how clearly Moses makes the point, you can't be saved by keeping the law. That will not save you. But there's one coming that will save you. You need to do what he says if you want to be saved. So it's basically telling Jews, it's the Messiah that's going to tell you how you can be saved. And the law won't do it.
So he's really saying your good works are not going to do it.
They're not going to do it.
He really says
that, and he actually predicts what's going to happen to the Jews after him. He says, you're going to think you can do it through the law, but let me tell you what's going to happen to your descendants. They're going to walk away from the law, and God's going to punish you and rebuke you.
More often when I read the Bible, because I know I read it, but it's just making me focus more now on what I have.
Well, the other thing that's good to do is to integrate that last sermon of Moses with the prophet Ezekiel. Those two hook together. And if you can get a Jew to listen to Ezekiel's sermons and Moses' last sermon, they get the gospel. Or at least it helps them get the gospel.
Ezekiel.
Ezekiel gives three sermons throughout his life. And all those sermons are targeting self-righteous Jews. Basically saying, you think you can do it through good works, it's not going to work. And what's wonderful about it, and by the way, I've used Ezekiel with Jews too, because basically what Ezekiel says is this. There's two ways you can be saved. Keep the law perfectly, or depend on the one that will come. And so this is how God's going to judge you. He says, you Jews think that you're going to make it because you're going to be facing judgment day, and God's going to weigh your good deeds versus your bad deeds. And you righteous Jews think, there's no way my bad deeds are going to outweigh my good deeds. Look at everything I've done. My good deeds are going to outweigh my bad deeds. But what you see in Ezekiel 18.
18 what?
Okay. Ezekiel 18 and Ezekiel 32 are the passages you need to look at.
18:32.
Right, chapter 32. And he basically says, this is what's going to happen on judgment day. God's going to look at all your good deeds and all of your bad deeds, and he's going to ask you a question. What did you do with my offer to save you from your inability to live up to this? And he says, if you think that you can trust in your good works to outweigh your bad works, then what I'm going to do is take the pan with all of your good works on it and dump it. It'll be empty. And I'll judge you on what's left on the other side. Now, for one that repents of their consistent rebellion against the Creator and trying to satisfy God's justice through their works, rather than the work of the Messiah. He says, I'll do the opposite. Good deeds versus bad deeds, I'll dump the scale with all the bad deeds on it. And you'll be judged just based on the good deeds. So, no matter, on Judgment Day, you will be weighed in the balance, but one of the pans will be empty. And you get to decide which pan is empty. And it's all based on what you do with God's offer to save you. So if you depend on yourself, then the deeds, the pan with all the good deeds on it gets emptied. Now, what's interesting in Ezekiel is when he preaches his message to the Jews, they all yell at him, God is not fair. This is not a fair way to judge. You know, we're really counting on those good deeds to outweigh our bad deeds. But notice Ezekiel preaches after the prophet Isaiah preaches. And what do you see in Isaiah 64? All your good deeds done to justify yourself are like filthy rags in my sight.
That's actually from Isaiah.
That's in Isaiah, right. So it's basically making the point that if you do these good deeds to exalt yourself, then that's pride. And, you know, that's the worst of all the sins. Yeah, it's all in the Tanakh, exactly. That's what's so wonderful about this. This is all in there.
And that's what blows my mind.
Yeah, it literally does. And it's a message we Christians need to appreciate too. On Judgment Day, one pan will be empty. I run into a lot of Christians who think, you know what, on Judgment Day, I'm going to have to make all these excuses for all the bad things I've done. And the promise of the New Testament is this. When you give your life to Christ, God at that moment forgets every evil and sinful thing you've done, words, thoughts, and actions.
My parents never forgot.
They might not forget, but God chooses to forget. Well, that's why it tells the New Testament, too, you need to forgive one another. God is forgotten, but your fellow man is not. So if you offended your fellow man, you need to go to him and seek forgiveness. But as far as God is concerned, if you've given your life to Christ, He has erased everything. On Judgment Day, you will not have to give an account for all the evil you've done.
So if I do that, I don't have to go up to everybody who's offended and say, I'm sorry, as long as I just believe in
you. Well, that'll take care of your relationship with God. It will not take care of your relationship with your fellow man.
Well, I'm more concerned with God than
myself. Right. But that's why we're told, yes, we do need to seek forgiveness for people we've offended. Because, yeah, they have not forgotten. Only God has forgotten.
I ask them for my forgiveness. It's going to take forever.
Well, that's something I struggled with in giving my life to Christ, is just thinking, I've offended a lot of people. And I made up a list, and I said, geez, that's kind of depressing, all these people I got to go to. But then what I realized is, okay, I need to prioritize that list. Okay, who should be at the top? Who should be next? Yeah. Yeah.
Can you come with me when I go to my house?
I think it'll have more credibility if you go by yourself. Yeah, go ahead.
So we can also send a letter.
Apparently, if it's Elijah more, why don't they have an empty seat for the Messiah also? Do they revere him more than the Messiah?
Well, they believe that Elijah will come before the Messiah. So the reason why they have an empty chair there, if that chair gets filled, we know the Messiah is coming. And see, that's part of Christian theology too. Is that, and that's why Jesus said of John the Baptist, he was the Elijah. But he didn't mean he was a literal Elijah. He was the one that did preface the way. And before the Lord returns again, if you read the book of Revelation, there will be one coming from heaven who represents the law, and another one who represents the prophets. So a lot of Christians believe that the book of Revelation is referring to the two witnesses that come down before the return of Christ and pave the way for the return of Christ, and that one is Elijah and the other is Moses. Because, you know, Elijah didn't die. Moses did die, but what does the text say? His body was not found. And so both in Jewish theology and Christian theology is the belief that God took the body of Moses because he's got a future purpose for Moses.
Well, in Jude, it talks about Satan fighting over the body of Moses.
Yeah, Satan and the archangel fought over the body of Jesus. But from that we can imply that Satan did not win. Well, that's another proof that Moses must have his physical body intact, because who appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration? Elijah and Moses. So that's another reason why Christians believe that the two witnesses that you see in Revelation are indeed Moses and Elijah. And they will die. They're going to die again. In the case of Moses, and Elijah will die. So that sense when people say, gee, I would need if I never had to die. Well, gee, even Elijah is going to go through death. He just hasn't died yet. Hey, I see I'm out of time. You're going to make some announcements, so...
Don't disappear. I'm going to have a break in, though.
Okay.
A few brief announcements before I ask Hugh to pray and to dismiss us. A lot of great things coming up this week. Wednesday here in the sanctuary will be an Ash Wednesday service. Pastor Paul will be leading, and I really appreciate your message this morning. It ties in directly with what our pastor was saying this morning. It's the great irony, obviously, that people are all, everybody is a slave. If you're trying to obey the law as the Jews, you're a slave to the law. Those that reject the law are slaves to sins, and it's the interesting irony that Christians that submit themselves to God are the only ones that are free. We're free from both the law and free from sin, and that's just a wonderful place to be. And someone that was a slave to the law for 2 years, obviously, I greatly appreciate the grace that God gives us. Reminder, obviously, that this coming Saturday or Friday and Saturday will be rummage in Pritchard Hall, and there's lots of ways to help with either donating. You can bring stuff to Pritchard Hall to donate or buy, and they're also still looking for volunteers to help. Would be greatly appreciated. Also then on Saturday night before you go to bed, make sure that you change your clocks. Otherwise, when you come to a Paradox class, you'll be here at the wrong time, and there's always a few people wandering around wondering what's going on because they forgot to set their clocks. So make sure that you you spring your clock ahead before you go to bed next Saturday. And, of course, also we hope to see you here tomorrow night for L.A. Chapter. And so those are the main announcements. Also, obviously, in the bulletins, be aware, obviously, on March 16th will be the Wisteria Festival, which means parking will be a problem, so you want to come a little bit early that day. But we'll announce that again in the future. Hugh, if you could close us in prayer. Thank
sure.
you.
Father in heaven, we want to thank you that we live in a day when we have 66 books of the Bible. And Father, I pray you'd make all of us students of everything that you've inspired these prophets and apostles to write. And help us, Lord, to see how it all fits together. And equip us in the process, Father, to reach out to those who don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, that they may see how these scriptures speak of you in mighty and consistent ways. In Jesus' name, amen.